Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast, where you'll learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secure retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlatnik.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. David Phelps of the Freedom Founders Mastermind Community and the Dennis Freedom Blueprint Podcast. Tonight, this is going to be a really fun conversation and a kind of a deep dive into some areas that I know a lot of you have been asking questions about, and that is, you know, how do you do due diligence? How do you do underwriting of potential investment opportunities, particularly in what we call the alternative investment space? We'll define that in just a minute, but before we get too far along, let me introduce my guest, Mr. Mike Zlotnick, affectionately called Big Mike. Mike, how are you doing, sir?
Hi, David. I'm doing great. How are you?
Super, super. So I got to tell you a little bit about Big Mike and how we met and why I enjoy him so much on a lot of different levels. Mike and I are part of another mastermind group called Collective Genius. It's a group of the top tier real estate, boots on the ground business owners, investors in multiple geographic areas across the U.S. And so we met there about 6 years ago. And Mike was one of the first guys I met there. I was new. Mike had already been part of Collective Genius for a bit. And we realized how quickly that we had a similar philosophy, even way back then, Mike. And as we've grown together to learn how to collaborate with each other, and that's really a key to tonight's message. It's about collaboration. How do you find the right people to do business with, to invest with, that can more promote your ability to get into the right deals, right investments without having to do the work all yourself or getting caught, you know, in mired in traps and things that you just don't know about, because it's a little bit of a wild, wild west. But if you know the right people, get the right access points, it's a tremendous way to go. So I'll give you a little bit more about Mike's background, but I will say this, Mike, into our audience, Mike is from Russia. If you won't figure out from his accent yet, he can give you a little bit about his story. And the number of years he's been in the real estate and financial space. But one thing he does, he always brings me a nice bottle of vodka. And I will say, I'm not drinking any vodka tonight. We're clear, we're good, but maybe afterwards, who knows? I might toast to you, Mike.
We'll break some bread and have another drink soon. Absolutely. At the next Freedom Founders event. So
be perfect.
Yeah, and David, I very much appreciate your kind introduction, and the feeling is mutual. The moment we met, I thought great minds think alike. We clicked really well, and we've been friends for years, and I appreciate the opportunity to be of service to Freedom Founders, and love working with you. There's the good old expression, who are the top five people who you surround yourself with. You are certainly one of these top five people, and I feel blessed by your presence and by everything you do. So thank you very much for having me. And yes, I'm from Russia with love.
Exactly. Well, you know, as I said, I've learned over the years, and I wasn't this way early in life, but I've learned through the years that if you find the right people, you just say, you know, who's your core five? And then, you know, the next circle out from there. But developing relationships, what I call relationship capital, I think is one of our most important assets. And a lot of people that are hardworking entrepreneurs, professionals, business owners, we've learned early in life to put the sack on our back and do the hard work, right? Do all the heavy lifting, because that's how we're built. And there's nothing wrong with a strong work ethic. But what we realize is by finding the right people in life, the synergy, the collaboration effect can give us all more what we're looking for. You know, it's what I call speed to goal, right? Speed to goal. And what do we do our work for in life, Mike? What do we do? You're going to ice skating and tennis this afternoon with your kids. I mean, isn't that really why we decide to have businesses and then further our freedom through wealth and passive income? Isn't that really why we do these things?
That's right. That's right. It is. That's the big, if you don't have a big why, it's tough to go through life.
Yeah, it's very tough to go through life. And so, you know, I used to always think, well, I need to control everything because I'm detailed and no one else can do the things as well as I can. But the problem is we only can have so much time and we can have expertise in certain areas. Like I've got expertise in kind of a large area of, you know, business and professional practice and a lot of experience in real estate. Mike, you on the other hand, again, we'll give you a little bit of your resume, but your background takes that to another level in terms of real estate, underwriting, due diligence. I mean, that's your world, and you've built a whole business in that arena. And I could say to myself, well, gee, I could just go do that for myself. I could just go build my own underwriting team and learn how to do all that stuff and go take some more courses. And yeah, maybe 5 or 6 years down the road and a lot of missteps, a lot of mistakes, learning by experience, I might, if I'm lucky, get to have your expertise. But wait a minute, I already know a guy that I have a track record with who I know has a history of doing things the right way, has integrity. That's key in collaboration. And when you find those people and do the due diligence on the person, the character, now you've got the ability to put things together. And that's really what we've been doing in Freedom Founders with each other. And we serve, you know, mutual clients and also have separate clients. And that's the way the world runs. So I just want people to understand there's nothing wrong with doing things yourself to a point, but you've got to at some level decide what's your time worth. What is your time really worth? And is it better to increase the pie and increase safety and then create more of what you're looking for rather than trying to control it all yourself, which takes longer, missteps, setbacks, testing, potential failures? It's a quicker way. So I just want to give that context and then also a quick look on my iPad. I'm going to switch your mic just for a second because you're going to go over this, but I want to just give a quick overview of kind of what we're looking at. The world of alternative investments. Well, what are alternative investments? Essentially, it's kind of everything that you can invest in outside of Wall Street. Stock market, bonds, annuities, insurance contracts, all that stuff on Wall Street. We're talking about outside that. So, you know, it could be precious metals. It could be cryptocurrency, if you like that kind of stuff. It could be stamp collections. I mean, it could be all kinds of art. But we're going to focus on what Mike and I love most, and that's real estate. So again, the world of alternative investments, it's exciting, it's fun, it has great opportunity, but like anything in life, it also has some risk. How do you mitigate the risk? So let me give a quick overview of how it's going to look. So on my fancy-dancy iPad, I've got just a little construct here, and then Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you. So three boxes. What we have in the three boxes is what I call, number one would be what I call one-off deals. The next box would be syndications, which is really our topic for tonight, and then funds, investing in funds. And one off would be, for example, starting at, you know, really the bread and butter of real estate investment would be single family residential, SFR, single family residential, which you can buy properties called turnkeys, or you can also lend money to people who have turnkey properties or fix and flip. So one off deals. You could go bigger if you've got the funds and the capabilities. You could also certainly do commercial, multifamily. You could do, you know, self-storage. You could buy a mobile home park if that's your thing. For most people that have businesses, probably not a good thing to do because it takes you off focus, right? Your time value. Syndications, I mentioned, is going to be the topic for tonight. And then we'll touch a little bit also on funds and where the place is for that. So again, you've kind of got the opportunity in life to do it yourself. And when you're young and you got more time than money, do it yourself's not bad. Just still get the education. When you're busy in a professional practice or a business of some construct where that's where your value is, then finding other people to work with is, I think, really the key. So, Mike, I'm gonna let you go ahead and share your screen, sir, and let's get into the meat of the topic tonight.
Sounds good, David.
While you're doing that, let me also say that we've got a lot of material tonight. Mike has prepared a really rock solid presentation here. We're gonna move relatively quickly, but understand you can also type your questions in the chat bar. And we'll be able to answer some of those as we go, either myself or Mike. And then also, as we look at the questions in the chat bar, that'll give us ideas for what you want next, because we're always glad to come back and serve again. We believe about in service first, because that's how we build the right people and the right team. So use the chat, if you will, as you go along. And then we'll also give you some other ways where you can do some follow-up with us, because we want to educate first. So Mike, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, David. Well, the topic of today's discussion is to look at investment-grade deals versus speculative. The whole universe of alternative investments has let's just call them investment-grade, high-quality deals, and then speculative deals. So we're going to look at the difference between investment-grade and speculative deals. And also, we're going to chat a little bit about how to underwrite commercial real estate syndication deals. The disclaimer, this is for educational purposes only. This is not an attempt to sell securities or anything else. The presenters here, David is an educator and runs Freedom Founders. I'm in the private lending and real estate fund management business. you know, flagship fund and secondary funds can only be invested through the private placement memorandum. If you're interested, please request one and consult your professional before making any decisions. David, do you want to give any disclaimers quickly?
Real quickly, as Mike said, we are not providing any offerings tonight. We are not selling anything. Truly, we want education. It's always education first. We'll provide next steps for anybody who wants to take whatever those next steps are. Really, our outcome for tonight's presentation is education. It's all about education. It's about giving you awareness of what the opportunities are, the pros and cons of what we have available through our world, our network. It's about opportunity and safety, giving you those next steps, whether you do it yourself or you want to involve yourself with other people who have strategic networks. So thank you, Mike.
Thank you, David. Who is David? David,
all right.
I'll take that one because
I've done extensive research on this fella. I'm David Phelps, formerly known as Jenna's dad. I'm the founder and CEO of the Elite Freedom Founders Mastermind Group, through which Mike Zlotnick is one of our key elite trust advisors and provides a lot for us. In brief, I started real estate investing before I became a dentist. Yes, I practiced dentistry for 21 years in private practice. It was my daughter, Jenna, that gave me a reason why to step away from clinical practice after 21 years. She had a lot of illnesses in her life, the last one being a liver transplant at age 12. That's when I decided no more of this. Fortunately, I had enough real estate built up that it gave me an opportunity to go to a plan B. I had avoided in my life. Doctors, dentists, physicians asked me, how did you do it? And long story short, Freedom Founders organically began about 8 years ago. And today we are serving hundreds of people in professional practice and businesses through our collaboration in helping them get safely invested in alternative investments, to provide them that passive cash flow that they need so they can have a plan B, have freedom, and ultimately, you know, transition out, slow down from their active income. So that's me in a nutshell. Mike, next slide, please.
Thank you for sharing your story. Who's Big Mike? I'm married with four kids and a cat. The cat should be in the picture, but next time. I'm a CEO of the TF Management Group and manage two primary funds, our flagship fund, Tampa Opportunity Fund, and a legacy fund, TF Investment Fund 2. Been actually a fund manager full-time since 2009. I had an IT executive management career from mid-90s till 2009, almost 15 years. But real estate has always been my passion. My wife, my family, as you can see, it's a zoo here. So we're always doing ice skating that's the primary, but we're also doing the tennis sport, tennis, dance, and swimming, and a few other things. My expertise and the focus has always been short-term bridge lending for fix and flip projects, and also invest in long-term value-add equity projects with focus on cash flow and value-add driven appreciation, projects in self-storage, multifamily, and retail. Mm-hmm. I do have a book out. You're welcome to get it on Amazon, or if you email it to me, I'm happy to send you a copy as well. And I do have a podcast called BigMikeFund.com podcast. And if you mistype it, instead of BigMikeFund.com, you type BigMikeFun.com. It is not a site. It is not, I promise.
Don't do that one.
That's just a URL forward.
So. That's good.
David.
All right. So because I know a lot of you are busy like I am, when I attend a presentation, webinar, education, you're busy. You may be multitasking. So just at the front end, we're just going to give you the opportunity for what are your next steps. Mike already mentioned that he has a book that you can get on Amazon, or he'd be glad to just send you one if you email him. Same for me. If you want to get one of my books, From High Income to High Net Worth, you can go to the link right there. It's freedomfounders.com/gift. And we'll send one out to you. No obligation, no catch, nothing at all. For some of you are fast trackers, you just know that you want to get more involved in alternative investments and find out how to do it the right way and be around people like myself and Mike in our network. You can apply to become a part of our Freedom Founders Elite Mastermind by going to freedomfounders.com/apply. We'll show these again at the end, but we want to give this to you early so that if you miss an opportunity to stay with us to the end, you have a chance to stay up with us. Mike, go ahead with the next one, please. Sure.
Again, I'm at your service. BigMikeFund.com is the podcast, and TampaFunding.com is our primary website. And the book is available on Amazon, and you can reach me at mike@tampafunding.com. Let me keep rolling. And my phone, please text me instead of calling. If you just identify yourself, I'll try to be responsive. Let's start by chatting a little bit about pros and cons of investing in syndicated real estate versus sort of individual deals. And I wanted to mention, a lot of folks love syndications, and there's a lot of syndications out there. But I wanted to cover a little bit of lay of the land, give folks a little bit of pros and cons on what the benefits and then drawbacks of syndication investing. So number one, it's a passive investment. That's the pro. The con of that is you have no control. You're relying on the sponsor to run the deal. So if you don't pick the right sponsor, you could be stuck in the deal for a long time. One of the benefits is depreciation benefits. So syndication would own a real estate, and it passes through as a partnership on a tax level. Most syndications run like this. They pass through depreciation to investors. The drawback on a syndication is lack of liquidity. Typically, you put your money in a project, and until there is an exit event or partial sale or refinancing or the full asset sale, the money is stuck, you have no liquidity. And most syndications restrict you from trying to sell your shares or units. One of the pros is if you find a good sponsor, you will benefit significantly from the experience and the track record. One of the drawbacks on the other side, when you get distributions in a syndication, you cannot reinvest them. Most syndications, when the cash comes out, it's one of the, it's not a big problem, but you need to know that.
Well, let me just take that for a second. So what you're saying is, obviously, we want to get money back and return on investment. So that's great. I mean, that's the whole idea. But the problem, if you will, is now you've got to go reinvest that money somewhere else to keep it working.
That's right.
Versus in some of the funds you'll talk about where those the return is reinvested, so it continues to compound. So it's not a problem if you have a network that you can keep your money invested in. So just want to make sure people understand why it's not really a problem, but something to be aware of, that you're still responsible for reinvesting the money somewhere else.
David, thank you for clarification. Exactly. It's just the money is no longer being, you know, there's no compounding on that money per se. Syndication, you can have potentially strong return based on the value add projects, based on the leverage and good management, and leverage works both ways. One thing you should be aware, and I've seen this issue across the board, so many people are not aware of this. If you're investing a self-directed IRA money into a syndicated deal, and there is a debt on the deal, it's a leveraged deal with some bank loan, your IRA participating in equity investment, it will be subject to UBTI tax, UBIT, unrelated business income tax. A more exact term for it is UDFI, unrelated debt, financing for income tax. Just be aware of it. Be very careful when you put your IRA into a syndication. You should always check the risk of a UBIT. Just, you know, side note.
Ask the question. Make sure you know if there is a debt leverage in that syndication, and then go back to your accountant or CPA and get the pros and cons. It's not that you shouldn't do it. It's just you need to be aware of what it is so you can offset, because the taxes potentially, if the returns are too high on the debt leverage portion, our tax at a trust account, trust rate, which can be significantly higher. So just be aware. This is something, as you said, Mike, that a lot of people, deal sponsors, don't make aware. People want to use their retirement accounts in syndications, and maybe don't know what to look for there. So good one.
Thank you for clarification. Again, one of the benefits is cash flow and capital gains while you're being passive. So you can benefit from real estate the same way as if you own a property. And one of the drawbacks of a syndication, you're not diversified. All your eggs in one basket.
On fund level, you get diversification. But also, I want to say this too, Mike, is syndication a little bit like individual deals? When a syndication, I've got a chance to put potentially more money. I get more money deployed, and I can still diversify if I put money in different syndications. So yes, in one syndication, sure, you're in that one project with other investors. But gee, if I've got a couple $1 million and I want to break that out over a number of syndications, which I know you're going to show some examples in your four quadrants in a little bit, you know, that's a way to do that. So diversification can be looked at in different ways, right? And so just, you know, for context, I do like syndications because I feel like I am getting a chance to participate in multiple syndications and also funds as well.
Thank you for clarification. Exactly. You can diversify among many syndications and funds. Typically, you get a preferred return. Just be aware there are no guarantees. Syndicate is not personally guaranteeing your money.
Can I go back to the one of the top ones again? You talked about one of the cons being no liquidity. Your capital is essentially stuck or it's invested in the syndication until sale or refinance. Remember, there's different buckets of money you want to invest. So just because there's no liquidity doesn't mean it's not a bad investment. And again, Mike's going to go into this in detail on that. For a lot of us that have active income, we are in business, we're in professional practice, we're paying plenty of tax right now, and an opportunity to invest with after-tax money means if we can go into more of a growth stage and not have that income, then we're not paying tax today. So not having the cash flow isn't a bad thing. It's one way that Mike will show you later how you can kind of balance risk cash flow with that growth. But you know, it's not a bad thing that you don't have growth. I like to balance my portfolio on some deals to have more cash flow on the front end and a little bit less on the growth, and sometimes the reverse. So just a little extra comment there, Mike. You realize I'm translating Russian into dental language, and so there's a little bit of a delay there because I have to like go back in my mind and understand the Russian part to make that translate. So go ahead, sir. You're doing great.
I appreciate clarification. It's going to get worse from the point of view. I'm also a mathematician, so you're going to see some math. So you're going to have to translate math into English as well. Okay. But let me keep rolling forward. The next one. So here's a quick comparison between individual deals investing. Individual deals could be a syndication also versus a fund. So just very quickly, because I want to keep rolling forward. When you do any single deal, whether it's syndication or you just buy one property, you have risk concentration, high volatility of performance. When you invest in a fund, you're diversified and you have generally low volatility. We already talked about low liquidity in a single deal investing. Generally, funds have much better liquidity. I mean, it depends on type of fund, but most funds that raise capital quarterly basis could certainly redeem also shares on a quarterly basis, and liquidity is much better on a fund level. When you do individual risk, you get potential personal liability risk if you sign a personal guarantee on the mortgage. Funds typically limited liability. Individual deal investing could be more active. Syndication, you're still passive, but if you buy a building yourself and you do some improvements, that's active, versus a fund is generally pretty passive. Also, individual deal, like we talked about, you could have idle funds between investments, the money you got back from dividend distributions. When you put the money in the fund, the money is always working. We already talked a little bit about IRA investors being aware of the risk of a leverage. In a fund, typically, there is no UBIT as long as there's no leverage on a fund level. So you absolutely have to check with the fund if the fund has leverage. We don't have leverage on flagship fund, but some funds do have leverage. So you just should be aware. And another interesting point is when you're investing into a single deal, you need syndication, may be a little different. Syndication might work like a fund. You could pick and choose the amount of money you're putting. But if you're buying a house, investment property, you're going to need a fixed amount of dollars to buy. When you put the money in the fund, you're flexible. You could start with less and then add later, or you could start with more and then take some money out. So from that perspective, you have a little bit more flexibility.
Mike, I was just thinking, I didn't do a very good job on the front end of really distinguishing between a syndication and a fund. A syndication would be where, again, investors are pooling money, bringing money together under a deal operator, a sponsor, who's going to manage the project, but it's going to be focused on one particular asset, commercial project, right? So one asset. So it could be ABC 123 Elm Street in Cincinnati, Ohio, or wherever. So you know what that is, multifamily, self-storage, so any kind of commercial. It's a building with an address. In a fund, on the other hand, a blind pool fund means the fund manager, you get the opportunity under the operating agreement to choose different assets. That's where the diversification comes from. And so there, we can understand what kind of assets you're investing in, but we're very diversified in that arena. So I just want to kind of make sure that people understood syndication, focusing on one particular asset, funds, multiple assets.
David, thank you for clarification. That's a brilliant point. Yeah, exactly. The funds have advantage of diversified set of investments, while the syndications typically won. But on the entry level, it's a pooled investment vehicle with many investors coming in. So thank you for clarification. Let me keep rolling. Now let's talk a little bit about the basics. So investing versus speculating. And many of you know who is Warren Buffett. Everybody knows who's Warren Buffett. Let me put it this way. And Warren Buffett's teacher was Benjamin Graham. And Benjamin is considered to be sort of the godfather of value investing. And what he said is an investment is an operation which one, through analysis, promises safety of principal and a satisfactory return. Everything else is speculative. So when you're thinking through that lens, when you're looking at any investment opportunity, the questions you're asking is there a reasonable degree of safety to the principal and a satisfactory return? That these are the key basic terms that you should think about when you're considering an investment. Speculation is pretty much anything else. Speculation is a financial action that does not promise safety of the initial investment along with the return of the principal sum. And the there are a lot of quality speculative projects, but you should absolutely be aware that you're investing into a speculative deal rather than an investment grade deal. So that's just a kind of lay of the land on the fundamental level.
Mike, one of the things to say, I think, about what you just said, investment grade versus speculative grade, is that we know where we are in the market cycle right now. We're kind of near the top. There's a lot of money chasing yield, chasing return on investment all over the place. And it's relatively easy for a lot of, I call them novice, hardworking, but novice capital raisers who are going out and finding, quote, deals all over the country, right? Again, commercial projects. And it's relatively easy to raise money today because there's a lot of money looking for a home. The problem is with a lot of these deals is they are speculative in nature. And they also, many times, Mike, and you're going to talk about structuring, but they don't give a very fair structure on the return to the investors. The benefit of working with somebody, a group, or the collaboration like we set up between ourselves and Freedom Founders is that you have the leverage where in this case, pooling our money, we can go to particular deal sponsors who we like and have that track record and actually set up preferred returns that we believe are more fair than what a retail single investor might get to do when they're maybe hearing of an opportunity through some kind of program or a seminar where people are selling their syndications. You just got to take what they give you. You have no opportunity to ferret through lots of opportunities. Mike, you get to look at multiple deals every week. I mean, that's the nice thing. You get to look at them, handpick them, choose them. You know the deal sponsors, and you actually get to go back and in some cases, not all, some cases, but you just say, you know what? Based on all the balancing of the risk factors, return, all the things you're good at doing, you can come back and many times get a better return for investors where the individual investor could not do that on their own.
Yeah, David, that's a great point. I so much appreciate you clarifying this. The strength in numbers. And when folks come to Freedom Founders and the significant amount of capital working together to be able to fund deals, it has the negotiation power and leverage and ability to influence the sponsors to improve deals. Don't just grab retail deals that are available out there. There are a lot of really bad retail deals. Just retail meaning that they're available to mom and pop, take it or leave it. You either click the invest button or you click yes or no. And those deals often are not good deals. Risk-adjusted return is not healthy, and the sponsor could be taking advantage of you. So please be careful out there. I'm not saying we're the masters of the world, but we have a little bit more experience, and we take great care of the members, trying to help them to make better decisions on investments that we feel have high degree of investment-grade safety. So that's my thoughts. Let me keep rolling forward. Okay, now we're going to talk a little bit about investment quadrants. So one of the ways to think about your investing is there's a whole universe of alternative investments, and virtually all of them, and right now we're going to be a little bit more focused on real estate, but other deals could easily fall into one of these four quadrants. And why four quadrants? Well, it's just an easy way to understand and appreciate what you are investing into. So think of the quadrant number one is an investment grade cash flow focused. So when you're investing into a project that's generating pretty good distributions and it has strong downside protection and the risk of problems. Again, we're going to discuss exactly how to identify the risk and assess the risk. But at the moment, assume lower level of risk, moderate to low. It's not zero risk, but lower risk. And a project can generate you low double-digit returns. IRR stands for internal rate of return. Think of it as an annualized compounding on average. So if you generate 10% for 10 years and you compound your investment, you will not have double the amount of money, you will have more. That IRR compounding is what gets your number a little bit higher.
Mike, does IRR include just the cash flow that comes out, or does it include cash flow and other distributions, more of the splits on the back end? What does it include? It
includes both.
Both, okay, very good.
So the IRR calculation may not be trivial, because it's sort of a function when this cash is distributed. So the formula is a little bit complex, but the way to think about this is if you got your money reinvested, the IRR would get... So your average per year would get enhanced. We'll get to an IRR slide in a minute, right. But it does include the back-end distributions. So think of the left top quadrant. Quadrant number one is a safe space. It's not guaranteed. I want to make it very clear. There's still a certain amount of risk. And typically, there are deals that fall into this space. So first lien loans, for example, or owning a single-family asset with a good bank loan could be that. Could be a multifamily syndication with conservative leverage, or a self-storage syndication with conservative leverage, but also fair splits and other protection mechanisms. So this quadrant is sort of this is called the safest quadrant. As you can see, the target return could still be very strong. Other quadrants imply there's a little bit higher risk, and that's why the IRR is projected to be a little bit higher. The reason to invest into more risky assets is when you're expecting a little bit higher return. So let me walk through other quadrants. The quadrant number two is also investment grade, but that quadrant is a growth quadrant. Plenty of projects. We have one deal coming up shortly where it's an investment in a non-performing note secured by strong collateral at a low LTV, and it's not generating cash flow. It's a commercial deal, but it's got strong downside protection from low LTV, and it's got really good upside because once the note is defaulted, there's a default interest rate, and investment like that fall into that category. There's plenty of other projects that do have some cash flow, but they're more focused on growth. So I'll give you some examples. Think of it this way. If you have a multifamily syndication, but it's not fully performing, there's fairly strong, significant value add component where units get renovated and then they get stabilized and the property starts cash flowing better in the future. So initial cash flow could be light, but the overall target return is higher because of the value at work. So those deals fall in the investment grade growth quadrant. There's a couple of other quadrants I just wanted to touch base on. The speculative quadrants, there's two of them. One is a cash flow focused, and then the other one is the growth focused. Both of them present a fairly high degree of risk, and investing in this type of project does take a certain degree of sophistication and level of comfort. So I'll give you an example. So quadrant three could be a highly leveraged deal with a lot of cash flow, but the leverage is very high, reserves are light, and it is sensitive to the market condition. So any ripples in the water could significantly hurt the cash flow. Or it could be a second lien loan that's generating you high yield. But there's a problem with the property in a second position, you're exposed to potentially catastrophic loss of capital. Well, let's look at quadrant four. Quadrant four is a very broad quadrant. There are a lot of deals today that fall into quadrant four. And nobody says it's a bad quadrant. It's just a much more speculative quadrant. So typically it means no cash flow, highly speculative deal. What kind of deals fall into quadrant four? Think of any development and redevelopment ground up. So you're talking about condos ground up, you're talking about construction of self-storage facility, even repurposing of a self-storage facility from an old Macy's, it's still speculative. These type of projects have a lot of risk. They depend on their strategy to be able to complete the project in timely manner, have enough cash reserves to be able to service the debt, and on top of that, be able to lease up as they project. There are risks on the way. Now, these projects could be great investments, but you have to understand that they're speculative projects.
And Mike, let me just add, I great quadrants. And I think, for me and for you, as we look at where we want to put some of our money, and again, we want to allocate probably a stronger amount of our money to the investment grade, maybe some smaller portions to speculative grade, depending on where we are in our career and how much debt we personally have, those kind of things. The big thing that we look at, even if we go to quadrant three or four, which we will do, and you do it often, is really comes down to the track record of the operator. So yes, you could look at a situation that could be more of a development or have limited cash flow until the distributions at the end. But who's that operator, right? How much do they know about the market? Is this something they've done on a regular basis, or is this someone who's into new territory? So this is, again, part of the due diligence that Mike is really good at doing, so that when you get an opportunity to do something, you go, well, you know, should I take a little bit more of a risk in a little bit of my money versus keeping it all in investment grade? So again, I like the way you presented this. Could you also give us just a brief discussion, just brief on what you talk about when you talk about downside protection? What does that mean?
Sure. So let me comment on first. We do take positions from a flagship fund and some speculative projects, but we're trying to take relatively small positions and diversify. So we do put a little bit of money in those. So they have a place because we believe the upside is very significant with strong sponsors. That's exactly what you said. Downside protection means in case there's a stress conditions on the project or there's a significant delay in getting to an exit point. So an example, let's just, again, look at a very specific example. We have a deal coming up where we're going to put a significant amount of money from the fund, and we believe a number of good, you know, Freedom Founders folks are going to put, where there's a syndication acquisition of a non-performing commercial note. So it's secured. There's a couple of notes in that deal, but at the moment, let me talk about that one. There's one $8 million note, and the collateral is $20 million or more. So when you're acquiring paper secured as a first lien position on that property, and then the developer on that project has run out of time and their loan maturity has hit. So we're going to buy that note, and the moment we're going to buy it, we're going to file notice of default and start the foreclosure. What is the downside protection? Well, it's the collateral. In case it takes 2 years to foreclose, it's a property in New York, it's going to take a while, we're going to basically take an asset that's worth a whole lot more than the loan. In this case, the loan is $8 million and it's accruing default interest. By the time it's done accruing in a couple of years, the accrued balance could be $13 million, but the collateral is worth 20 plus million, most likely even more. So that's the downside protection on that deal. It's not guaranteed, but it's, you know, it's fairly solid. Give you, so loans at a healthy LTV, loan to value ratio, do have the downside protection, because even if the deal goes sour, you're very likely to recover your principal. And most likely you can recover a good amount of interest. Some cases, if things don't go great, okay, you will lose a portion of your interest, maybe all your interest, but you get your principal back. So the risk to catastrophic loss of capital is fairly low. If you take example of even leveraged equity deals, some multifamily or some self-storage deals, where they have leverage, they're not in first lien position. They are actually an equity holder, but there is a very healthy bank loan. There's significant cash flow to cover debt service. There's all kinds of reserves, and the asset can withstand market stress. So what if the rents go down by 10%? What if the occupancy goes down by 10%? Can it still stay afloat? And those type of projects have downside protection because they can survive a stress. Now, we're not talking about catastrophic loss. If there's a massive earthquake and breaks half the city and insurance companies go bust, there's the possibilities of those type of, let's just call them freak of nature events, catastrophic events. But under normal circumstances, most of these investments will have fairly decent downside protection.
And I wanted to just compare and contrast in alternative investments, the downside protection versus, let's just say, Wall Street stock market. So what Mike's talking about here, with proper due diligence and keeping that downside risk at a level that meets our expectations, we don't expect to lose principal. In the stock market, how often do people lose principal? Happens all the time when there's a reset. So that's a big difference between alternative investments and what we consider risk factors versus what you see in the stock market. That's all I'll say about that.
I appreciate that. There's a lot more predictability, especially in real estate. Again, it's not guaranteed, but it's predictable. So let me keep rolling forward. All projects have risks, and I want to stress this out. I'm not trying to scare anybody, but if you think there's no risk in investment-grade projects, that's wrong. But there's always risk. Let me give you some examples. So there's always construction risk, there's a local zoning or government regulation risk, there's occupancy risk, insufficient capital risk, environmental risk, local and broad economic conditions, financial number may not come through the way that we're projected. There's a key man risk, the project sponsor, there's a natural disaster risk, and so on. So the risks exist, but the investment grade projects have lower degree of risk, and then the speculative projects have much higher degree of risk. So I wanted to stress this out, not to scare anybody. You can get great results in real estate. Just be aware that these investments are not guaranteed and not risk-free. As long as you understand the risk and you can manage the risk, you can do well. Keep rolling forward. Okay, so now we're gonna talk about risk-adjusted return and volatility. This is an incredibly important topic. I apologize for too many numbers, but I wanted to convey the point. I hope that these numbers speak the story here. So when you invest in quadrant one, and it's investment grade focused on cash flow, there's still possibility of some underperformance. Now, you may not lose all the capital, but there might be some issues with the project, and you might wind up getting a return less than the projected number. And this is where the loss reserves come in. Loss reserves don't necessarily protect you against losses. But if you think about it, 1% loss reserve could mean out of 100 projects, one of them goes completely bust. And if you diversify, that 1% loss reserve will take care of the problems. On average, mathematically, loss reserve, what it does, creates a safety margin. So if you expect it to make on the project 10 to 15% and you have 1% loss reserve, then your risk-adjusted return, ROI, is 9 to 14%. It's a little bit lower because your losses are not expected to be high on a project like this, even when things don't go well. So that's a key point, that the investment grade cash flow focus, their downside protection is strong and their loss reserves are fairly low. And generally speaking, projects in this category have low volatility. What does that mean? It means that if you're projected 10 to 15%, you might wind up with 16%, you might wind up with 9%, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, but you're not gonna be in the 25% range, you're not unlikely to be in the 2 to 3% range. The predictability of the investment is much higher and volatility is low. Does that make sense?
Perfectly, yes, sir.
So as we're rolling through into quadrant two, it's also investment grade. The risk is fairly low, moderate. The only difference here is that the loss reserve is probably a little bit higher. We're not talking about anything seriously higher. It's just less cash flow. You're relying a little bit more on value add component of the project. And the risk adjusted return is still very solid. And the volatility is generally also not very high. So the investment grade projects, they have all kinds of benefits, predictability of likely return. They have low loss reserves. The IRR is generally solid if you invest in the right projects. Now let's look at the speculative projects. So speculative projects, you may have a higher target IRR, higher projected returns. But the problem is you have very high loss reserves. So when we do second lien loans, we generally think of the problem rate as being 6%. There's no, by the way, these are examples. These are not, it varies investment to investment. But speculative projects have much higher volatility and they have high loss reserves. When problems happen, the problems are significant. So the good projects need to have, need to do better to have sort of these higher loss reserves to protect against the problem projects. So that the same is true for cash flow on speculative side and the growth as well. The growth needs to have probably similar loss reserves, but the volatility on both of them is pretty high. So those are my thoughts.
Yeah, quick question. So when you're talking about loss reserves, when you're doing underwriting of a syndication, is that something that the deal sponsor, the operator in this case, is going to have that built in and stated in the offering documents?
Good luck with that.
Okay, so
they don't. What they do is they project. They'll write their pro forma projection. They'll say your target return in that syndication is 16% or 16 to 18%. Usually put one number. They could put even a high number, 25%.
Yeah.
The problem is, first of all, you got to be able to read between the lines. So that projected return could be under ideal scenario. It's a marketing pitch. They're basically putting an idealistic number. The chances of that happening are not great. The other thing that they don't put is how many times these type of projects fail. When they fail, you lose all your money. So you have to be budgeting for higher losses in these type of projects because the risk is higher. Does it make sense? Even though the stock doesn't say anything about it.
Yeah, so this is one of the benefits of being connected to somebody like yourself who is able to read between the lines and give these assessments back to people that are more novices and wouldn't know where to begin to start. I mean, you're able to do that and collect the data, and because of your connection to the deal sponsor, you can dig deeper. And if it's someone you know well, which is typically who you deal with anyway, you can get to the heart of whatever it is and really give good feedback to the potential investors.
Yeah, David, I appreciate the thoughts. What we try to do, we try to assess the risk to the best of our ability. And it's not always trivial. It's not always linear. Hey, listen, on the speculative grade, 1 out of 10 projects fail. Well, it doesn't work that way, right? You may have periods of time when new construction does extremely well. When the market is booming, every single one is going to do well. A wide majority of them will do well. But when the market is crashing, 50% of them are falling apart. So that's the problem. So assessing risk is not always just a single project. It depends on market conditions and another variable.
Well, and exactly. So follow up on that. That's what I love about you. You and I talk about this all the time. Where are we in the market? We share a similar philosophy. And as we're looking at whatever kind of deals we're looking at, syndications, assets in your fund, or even individual one-off deals, both of us are always talking about, well, what's a kind of a worst case scenario as we're hitting kind of the top of the market? You and I are planning for some kind of reset at some period of time. We're building that in to our constructs right now so that not if it happens, but when it happens, we feel like we have done our risk assessment on wherever we're putting our money. And that's, again, I think a big positive of what your ability to underwrite brings to the table.
David, thank you for the thought. Great minds think alike. I'm in the same train of thought that we've been running too good for too long. Things are going to slow down. We may not have a great recession, but we may have some level of recession. And when it happens, speculative projects typically take heavier hits. So investing today in a down market in the investment grade with good cash flow is probably number one, job number one, let me put it this way.
And it's also an opportunity, Mike. We talk about how to make money in all markets, up markets, kind of stagnant markets like we're in right now, and markets that drop. And the cool thing is you can make money in all markets if you know how to do the risk assessment and you're connected to the right people, because just like the deal you talked about in Brooklyn, that's in what we call a relatively hot market, but probably with more novice developers who didn't keep enough capital reserve and they run out of money. Well, watch the market tip a little bit. Do you think there's going to be more opportunities that show up like that?
A whole lot more, like gangbusters.
So again, Mike's connection to so many people allows us to leverage our money through someone like him, through all his connections. And it's like, watch out. The big wealth transfer happens during those resets. And, I want to be on the receiving end, not the giving end.
The good old joke here in New York, you don't want to build these new condo projects and developments. You want to land on them. You take over. All of them are speculative. They're not relying on cash flow. They just want to build and hopefully sell at a premium.
Yeah.
So let's just talk a little bit more about quadrants, and I want to talk a little bit about cash flow and appreciation. So when you look at the IRR, it is a sum of the cash flow and a back-end appreciation. Back-end typically happens when the project is sold. Some of it could be captured on a refinancing. But it's an increase in the value of the asset. So good cash flow projects typically have distributions on an annual basis in the 7 to 12% range. It doesn't have to be exactly, but it's a solid distribution. And the appreciation on these type of project investment grade cash flow could be from light to pretty significant. It all depends on type of project. So depending on the strategy, you could actually see returns in the high teens and in 20s in this bucket. Even though the general range that I like to use, and again, it's a sample range, that doesn't mean it changes from time to time, from market condition, deal to a deal. But the total return is in the 10 to 15% range. So some of the examples of these deals. So funds like our flagship fund, Tampa Opportunity Fund, Ryan's Fund, Heritage, and then many, I call them quality cash flow syndications and multifamily self-storage and office space. And there are other funds as well. Let's talk a little bit now about the investment-grade growth projects. So these projects have generally low or no cash flow. So the project we just talked about, that deal in Brooklyn and Queens, actually has a little bit of cash flow because it's a mix of a non-performing note and a performing note. And the performing note actually generates a little bit of a yield. That project is supposed to yield around 4% annualized. So you could actually see some cash flow in the growth sector and the growth. You'll have, you know, sometimes people say growth and income, some people say income and growth. I would say the quadrant one is income and growth, and the quadrant two is growth and income. So the average IRR is a combination of a stronger appreciation and a little bit of cash flow. So an example would be non-performing notes, syndications with a good LTV or individual notes, could be heavy value add projects, multifamily, self-storage, with what puts them still in the investment grade category is the fact that they at least have a break-even cash flow either during the worst times. So when they're rehabbing units heavily and then they are bringing fixed units to the market, even during the worst times, they don't need to go to investors for more cash. They're self-sustaining and they're going through that period maybe of low distributions or no distributions, but the upside is very significant. So those are investment grade growth projects. On the speculative side, you got in the third quadrant, high risk, it's a cash flow focus. Easy example is heavily leveraged syndications. And then secondly, loans. We talked a little bit about that already. And then in the speculative grade, growth, typically ground up construction, development, redevelopment, land speculation. Have to be extremely careful with land because the value of the land varies quite a bit depending on the highest and best use. So let me keep rolling forward. Capital allocation. So David, you touched a little bit on this, especially in this market. This is an example of how an investor could think about this. They don't have to follow these formulas. They could change it. These are examples. But if you're looking for downside protection, if you're looking for predictability, you should probably put more of your capital in the safer investments. They're not guaranteed, but they're safer investments, more predictable investments. Typically, quadrant one could get giant share of the capital. Quadrant two could get a very good portion as well. In this case, I'm using 50% for quadrant one, 30 for quadrant two, and a little bit for quadrant three and four if you feel enough, if you have a taste for a little bit higher risk and you can deal with it with a tolerance and you're not going to get nervous about a single problem in that space. So as long as you're comfortable, you could make a little bit more money in those, or try to make a little bit more money in these speculative investments. Just be aware that there's a good old expression. If you can't afford to lose that money, don't put it there. So if you're not going to sleep well at night and you're going to put 10% of your portfolio in a condo construction, and it's going to make you nervous and you're going to wake up five times a night, just don't do that. So let's keep rolling forward. Quality cash flow syndication and similar funds. Now, this is an example. This is an approximation of what it is. Again, deals vary, and you have to look into each deal one at a time. But in general, I wanted to give you a little bit of an overview. So multifamily, self-storage, retail, office, even industrial deals could be strong cash flowing deals. And they're often syndicated. So that on the value add component, typically strong cash flow deals don't have a major value add. Just to be clear, value add, we love value add projects, but it's not both. You can't get great cash flow and you can't get massive value add. It's really hard to find those projects. The most projects will have light to moderate value add, typically cosmetic stuff, staying at the high occupancy while the project is going through innovation. And depending on type of value add, it varies. So in a retail, for example, syndication, the value add may be sale of an out parcel. In a multifamily, it may be renovation of units. In a self-storage, it could be existing facility with strong cash flow and a lot right next door, you can expand it. So you're doing a little bit of ground up construction, but the bulk of your, you have a good core foundation cash flowing business. So depending on the sponsor, most sponsors will tell you the story and their improved management. And I love the story. Some sponsors add a lot of value. Some sponsors don't. So you just need to kind of read between the lines. But generally speaking, it's a lease up. It's an additional services, additional fees, better collection, better mix of tenants. You could take a property that's in the C type of neighborhood and you improve it and you can make it into C+ and to B, you could actually improve the value by even changing some of that. In commercial, it's a very typical exercise is to improve lease, the quality of tenants. So the cash flow. So cash flow could be a little bit lighter in the first year. Let's just call it the value add year. So you're, when you're looking into a syndication with a value add component, and the value add is generally upfront, be prepared that the first year the cash flow may be a little bit lower.
Don't get because it takes some time to do, make the value add whatever it is, and then the cash flow comes after that, right? So that's why it takes a little time. Just be patient. You understand what the project looks like.
That's absolutely right. So as long as there's a value add and there's a lease up, and you could see, that's why when you look at a project, people look, well, what's going to be average cash flow? Don't look at the average. Look year by year, year one, year two, year three, year four. There is a story. There's always a story. Read the numbers. Moderate debt leverage. So I don't like projects where they borrow 90% or 85% or 80%. It's too much leverage. If there's ripples in the water, you could have problems. Leverage 60 to 70%, sometimes 75% is generally good. And the cash flowing projects with good downside protection doesn't have high leverage. That's a general pattern.
And let me say something about leverage. I talk to people all the time about, you know, leverage is the way to increase the rate of the growth of your assets, your equity, your wealth, and to do it through a syndication or a fund where you are not having to sign your name with personal guarantees. You don't have to go to the bank to get the leverage like you would for an individual deal if you were buying a single family house or you were trying to buy a multifamily yourself. You're going to sign away on that. In this case, the syndicator sponsor or the people in the fund will handle that for you. You get the same benefit of what are really historically long-term fixed rate, low interest rate opportunities, and that increases the yield. What Mike's saying is, Don't deal with people or syndications where they're increasing the debt leverage to like as high as 90%. Way too high. There's not enough margin there for bumps in the road. But as he said, 60, 65, 70, even 75% in the right projects can give you a huge benefit as an investor in these opportunities.
David, that's a great point. Thank you for the clarification. It's just an example came to mind. Recently looked at a deal. I think you know that we looked at. I looked at the deal and then we analyzed it and it had 85% leverage.
Too much.
Yeah. And it was a self-storage deal. And I looked at it and it's like, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, why 85% leverage? And it turned out to be a hard money loan. So they borrowed expensive money to maximize their return. But the reality was it because of that high leverage and it was expensive money, it created so much extra risk. Instead, they could have gone to the bank and gotten 70, 75% normal bank loan. It would have been lower rate and it would have been lower leverage, lower risk, but they would have had to raise a little bit more equity capital.
And so
from that perspective, you need to understand if you're investing in equity of the deal, you want to be behind a safe bank loan with good fixed interest rate instead of hard money at double digit interest rate.
And the problem with those deals is that the deal sponsor is betting that the economy will stay strong and betting they can get through this deal. And if they do, then it's good for everybody. But the downside is, what if they don't? Who's taking the majority of the risk in a deal like that?
Yeah, that's what drives me absolutely crazy when sponsors come forward and they want investors to take all the risk and then they want to capture a giant side of the upside. Yes. That's just unfair. And so here's an example. We're at a perfect place. So now we're going to talk about splits. So preferred return and splits. Now, it doesn't have to be just, not all projects are run like this, but many are. So normally, when you invest in a good syndication quality project, there's going to be a preferred return to investors.
And what does that mean? I mean, spell it out. What does a preferred return to me as an investor mean in a project like this?
It means that before a sponsor is going to get paid, other than a small management fee to keep the asset going, the first cash flow, the first distributions, the first set of capital gains should be paid to investor. It's typically the preferred return should be cumulative. Generally, it's not compounded. What cumulative means is every year, if they promise to you preferred return of 8% and the project didn't have enough cash flow to give you 8%, it carries whatever shortage into the next year, it accumulates. So what it means is that over years, if the project is underperforms, sponsor is not going to make money and you're going to get short. It means they got to catch up to the preferred rate of return before they can get performance fees. So it creates a floor. It's not a guarantee, but it creates a floor on your return. So I like projects with preferred return in the 8 to 12% range. There is no specific, you know, it doesn't have to be. There are projects with lower pref, could be 6%, could be even lower. There are projects that have no pref, and they're absolutely fine because they have a fair split. So typically, there's a balance between the higher the pref, the lighter the split for the investor versus sponsor. But here's an example. So you can have a project with, let me give you an example in the retail. So in the retail, a lot of deals go with 8% pref, and then the split is 70-30. It's a common setup.
And Mike, just to be clear, yes, 70% to the investor, 30% back to the sponsor. Just make sure people understand where the split goes. So the investor, 8% on the preferred, and 70% of the back-end value.
Right. Yeah, it's the backhand plus the cash flow. If the cash flow is stronger than 8%, yes, then at that point it starts falling into the split 70-30. Again, as you can see here, I don't even look at the deals with the reverse direction. So if a deal has a split 60-40, it may be acceptable. 70-30 is common. 80-20 is good. There are deals with no pref and 80-20 split, and they're just solid deals. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, if you have a decent pref, you may settle for 60-40. If you don't have a pref, you got to ask for a bigger number. Sometimes the projects will have an IRR hurdle. All that means is that if they delivered a certain level of return to you, just say 18% for the sake of the argument, at that point, that ratio of 70-30 can change to 50-50. At that point, the sponsor met good performance hurdle, and then from there, they're capturing more upside, and that's absolutely fine.
So as the investor, if I'm in a project and I've got a 8% pref and a 70-30 on the investor sponsor split, and now my cumulative yield up to a certain point hits 18%, what we call the IRR hurdle, then after that, we might shift to a 50-50, which as an investor, I'd be fine with that. If I'm hitting 18%, on a passive deal, I'm happy to let the deal sponsor come back in because obviously they've done a good job.
That's right. That's exactly right, David. That's exactly how it goes. Let me keep rolling forward. And then the most important element of these deals is high integrity sponsors, strong track record, and good communications. All those things we look at as part of underwriting. Let me keep rolling forward. Now, we have a couple of slides on the technical details of underwriting. I don't know if we have the time. I can quickly touch on some of these key discussion points.
What I'd say. Yeah, I'd say for the sake of time this evening, and folks, you realize how much goes into this and why you want to be, you know, in the network and have people like Mike Zlotnick that can help guide you. There's a lot to go in through here. What I would say, I'm just looking at this slide, Mike. I'm going to say that, you know, again, just to reiterate the key aspects of any kind of due diligence and underwriting, whether it's real estate, business, anything you're looking at, you got to look at who you're investing with. In this case, it's called the project sponsor, the deal operator, number one. And you've got the key things: integrity, experience, track record. Who do you know that knows this person, like Mike? Second would be the actual collateral, the asset itself. And Mike's got those things there. So structure and project financials, the key thing there is, are you part of a group that has leverage that can go back to, or actually on the front end, not only put in a structure that is fair to the investors, but also one thing you might mention there would be controls. Maybe just a little piece on, because you're really good at setting up controls in particularly projects that have multiple value adds or developments or redevelopments. Mike, talk about control.
Sure, David. So as part of the underwriting, especially when we have the ability to influence the project, we basically come to the sponsor and say, if you want our money, not only we want acceptable terms, but we also want to be in the position that if you have a problem, if you're failing, for whatever reason, God forbid you're hit by a bus, or you're just unable to function, or something happens, that point, there's some kind of default clauses that get triggered. We want to be able to step in. So the way, you know, we do it, just give you an example, we would set up, you know, a holding company in Delaware, and that entity would get the money, and it would have the right operating agreement to enable us to step in if there's a problem. And the problem conditions are defined. The project sponsor understands what they are. And if they perform, we never have to worry about those. And if they don't perform, they'll have time to correct it. But if they can't correct it, then we come in. At least we have the opportunity to quickly seize the project, seize the asset, and be able to work with it rather than going through litigation and long process to to try to fight the sponsor for not doing their work. So you're
able to do this because attorneys write the documents with specific triggering events very clearly defined, and it's already set up so if there is a default by the specifics in the operating agreement, then we can, as the investor group, can take control. That doesn't mean we as the investors have to go do anything. It's, again, through the network that people like Mike has, that if control was wrested away from the original sponsor, could be provided to many people on our network who could take it in a heartbeat and run with it. So don't think you have to step in as an investor and be involved. It's just a fail-safe mechanism that Mike's smart enough to put into the deals.
Yeah, exactly. And we try, not on every project is possible. There are very good sponsors, and then yep. they run good business, and this is unnecessary. But on a speculative projects where there's a degree of concern, this type of mechanisms are important as a way to step in and help a problem project. And as you mentioned, we do all kinds of due diligence work, project level, asset level, financial structure, and project financials. Just quickly, we talked a little bit about the sponsor, and we do all kinds of, we don't want to take the business call from the street.
Right.
If we don't know who's coming to us, we're not going to even talk to them. So the joke is the broker, brokers, jokers, we don't want to hear their business. We don't want to hear those transactions. We're trying to go much deeper with the right sponsors. So the people who we know, like, and trust, we've been working with them for a good amount of time, and they show good integrity and good ability. We try to understand their business and enable them with more capital and support to do more of what they do well. So that's the key approach to sponsor. And we do look at all kinds of their track record, experience. One thing that I like, just for the point of discussion, when somebody's coming to you and says, listen, I generated 10% for the last 5 years, that's great. But what did you project to generate? Very, very often, looking at the projections versus the results is the way to look at the track record.
Exactly. Mike, why don't you jump? You've got some really good slides in there, but I think we've covered enough of it. Why don't you jump down to the slide that starts with deal fairness and risk-adjusted return calculations? Let's do that one.
Okay. So this is a capital stack, just for the folks to quickly understand. The senior debt is the lowest risk. It's a low risk, a potentially lower return. The preferred equity and junior debt is sort of a second on the capital stack, and then the common equity or joint venture equity is the highest risk. Let me keep rolling forward. Let me just mention again, what is IRR? IRR stands for internal rate of return. The easiest way to think a little bit about this is it's a compounded average annual return versus the non-compounded average return. So think of it this way. If you generated non-compounded average annual return of 20%, your IRR on the same project would be probably around 15% because it includes compounding. Let me jump to the slide where, which slide do you want? Fairness of a deal.
Yeah, right there. Mm-hmm.
So this is really important. We've looked in the deals where the sponsors bring the deals to the table, where they, I can't put it any other way other than a wolf in sheep's clothing. I mean this with all due respect. There are bright, brilliant sponsors, but they're so good that they make a deal that they should give up a lot bigger chunk of the equity in the deal, and they want to make it look safe so investors would invest at poor terms, and a sponsor would capture giant side of the upside. And those deals are not fair. And the fairness is not just for the sake of the fairness. It's for the sake of the risk-adjusted return. So when you're not getting enough upside, you're taking more risk and not enough return, and that's why these deals don't work. So here's some examples. If you is a loan secured by a first mortgage with a strong collateral a high risk deal? No, it's a low risk deal. The loss reserves are low, and your risk adjusted return is generally is healthy. So a deal like this, you may not ask for as much return because the risk is low. What if you take an equity deal with the leverage of a bank loan? Hard money or just a bank loan and no external collateral. That's a high-risk deal. It means that your capital is at risk. You as an investor taking all the risk, and the sponsor is not guaranteeing you anything. So these type of deals need higher loss reserves, and we need to you need to reduce the projected IRR by a significant loss reserve amount. So equity deals where investors put up majority of all the capital need to give investors higher upside than the sponsor or deal operator. This is a key point. So it doesn't have to be much higher, but it generally should be higher. It also depends on how much work the sponsor is doing. The sponsor is doing a lot of work and they're very experienced and they're bringing massive amount of their expertise, then the balance shifts a little bit. But when the deal is speculative and the project operator or sponsor wants giant share of the upside, those deals are just not worth even discussing further. So here's an example. If a project on an asset level generates 20% on average per year, and the investors get 12 to 14% and the sponsor gets 68, that is a reasonable split. I'm not saying it's a investor crazy good split, but it's a reasonable split. So really good split would be maybe 80-20. Investors would get 16%, sponsor would get only 4%. So, but it can't be the other way around where investors take all the risk and then they get 40% of the upside while the sponsor gets 60%. That's not fair. That's not right risk-adjusted return. Let me keep rolling forward. So here are some examples of the fair splits. Split with deal with 8% preferred return, 1% management fee to the project sponsor, and 70-30 split, 70 to investors, 30 to the sponsor is absolutely fine. Another example, the preferred return could be 9%, and then the split could be 70-30 in favor of investors. And upon reaching an IRR hurdle of 16%, it reverts to 50-50. That's also a fine deal. Another example of deal number three is when there's no preferred return, but there's also no annual sponsor fees. And there's only 80-20 split, and that is a normal scenario. That's fine. When bigger deals, by the way, the splits get even bigger in the favor of sponsor. So there are deals where the sponsors get 90-95% on a really, really big commercial deal. With the operator, the upside is so significant, even on a small percentage. Here's an example a little bit different from what we just discussed previously. So there are situations where a project sponsor or the operator could get more than 50%. And that typically happens if they put up a really high pref. And we have deals like that, where the project sponsor are creating so much value, they're so comfortable with high pref that they don't mind. So we have a deal, an example we like, where the pref is 24%. And then the sponsor gets 75% of the upside and the investors get only 25%. But again, the IRR of 24% must be reached before sponsor gets any money. So projects like that, they create really high floor for investors. And then from that perspective, they may be acceptable to take less than 50%. Here's another example where the pref could be 18% and the split could be 30-70 because the high pref, it compensates for a lower split. And there are projects, again, with varying split, starting with 70-30 and over time could become 50-50 and over time could become 30-70 once they reach a high IRR hurdle. So those are all fair projects.
So Mike, with deals like these with a higher preferred return to the investors, that's got to be a really solid, very confident deal operator sponsor on a project or that they do on a regular basis. They're just very confident to pay that, which I like as an investor. I like that kind of deal. And the question I think a lot of people would ask is, how can a deal sponsor and operator of seems like a ton of money? Can you just give a brief explanation as to how that's possible?
Sure. So I'll talk about the project we have on that 24% pref. And it's a very heavy value add project. It's such a significant value add that within 2 years, the renovation on that complex of multifamily units in Georgia is going to be greater than the original acquisition amount. Everything is getting renovated. It's almost like it's the buildings are being not necessarily rebuilt, but the roofs change, electric plumbing changes, all the units internally change, exterior siding gets changed, common areas improved, facility in general gets improved. So the renovations are so significant that that project is going to go from all in with all kinds of cost of $25 million to the value being upon completion of a cycle, $40 to $45 million. So the value add is so big, and that project has equity of $5 million and debt a little over 20. So let's just say $25 million for sake of a discussion. So the equity investors, 24% pref for 2 years on $5 million is going to be, you know, a little bit less than $2.5 million, $2.4 million. So when that happens, the upside created is larger, so the sponsor actually wants to pay that high pref so they can keep 75% of the upside.
Yeah.
But the only way it's possible is when the value add is just so significant. For investors, you could argue, listen, guys, you know, do you want to take very high pref or do you want to take, you know, 8 pref and then some kind of a split? There's argument either way. If the sponsor is really set in their head that they want higher upside and then they push on this and you can't really get them to move when you're negotiating the deal and they want to pay you 10% pref. That deal, by the way, started with 10% pref. We pushed the sponsor through a side letter on our money to give us 24% pref.
Because you bring the leverage of being a person who can bring educated capital to the table that's there for the right deals, the right time, the right sponsors.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Exactly. So when we're negotiating deals for Freedom Founders folks, we're going to push hard to get them that kind of a deal. If we feel that the sponsor doesn't have too many options, then we'll do that. We're not trying to be cheapest money. We are reliable money. We give folks opportunities to come to us, get reliable capital, and they get support. And when, it's very valuable. Folks who are looking for cheapest money, they're going to offer those crappy deals to the wide masses. They're going to do massive Facebook, Google ads, all social media, and they're going to blow their own horn. They're going to promote themselves, and they're going to think they're the best guys in the world. I'm not saying anything wrong with them. So much for power to them. But they're not bringing fair deals. They're just trying to capture attention of investors who don't know better and give them money for these type of projects. We respect those deals. We'll look at them. I think I have a slide on those deals. Just give you some examples. There we go, bad deals. So these deals, when you see them and you hear them, it hurts my eye to even look at them. The deals that they're offered, that they're taking all the risks with capital and they're getting a little bit of return. If things go well, they'll get their return. If things don't go well, they'll get, you know, deep trouble, they'll lose their money, and ultimately they're going to be, you know, very unhappy. So it deals with a preferred return, 8 to 10%. Also, I've seen non-cumulative pref. It doesn't have to be, but some sponsors, they'll put 8% pref, and then the project has 2 years construction, and there's no cash flow, and it's non-cumulative. It's baloney. It just means you have a pref, you got to accumulate for 2 years. So I've seen that. I've also seen heavy acquisition fees. Just be very cognizant. Sponsor is acquiring an asset, and then they're charging 6% acquisition fee. Give me a freaking break. I mean, they're getting so much upside, and they're getting a ton of cash up front. They're not getting paid to perform. They're getting money. They're getting paid to buy, which is ridiculous. Right. They should be performing on the back end. On our fund level, we get paid zero, zilch. We never can charge the fund asset acquisition fee. We get paid on the back end when we perform. So when people charge this type of heavy acquisition fee, it's ridiculous. And the split, when you start reading the split, and it's 90% of the sponsor. You're thinking, what? Is this a joke? Is this a mistake? So that's one bad deal. Another bad deal, here's an example. And I know great sponsors call for this because they can. They have major educational marketing programs, the phenomenal guys, and folks invest with them just because they are well-known. So here's another deal, preferred return 6%. There's a typically 2% annual management fee. And then there's a heavy acquisition fee up front. And then there's a performance split called 50-50, but it's not even above the pref. It's just from day one, it's 50-50. And then investor gets paid first 6%, and the sponsor gets paid the next 6%. And after that, on a back end, when there's a split continuous 50-50. The moment investor reaches 12% annualized,
that's it.
They get no more.
Yeah.
So these type of deals, they are for very unsophisticated investors. Unfortunately, people just don't know better. And when you come to Freedom Founders, we won't let you come close to these deals. We're going to do deals so much better. The deals that look like these deals and then these deals. The deals 1 through 5 are the solid deals. So that's our whole job. And not only that, a lot of these deals that we're bringing to the table, I as a fund manager underwrite them for the fund to invest. So generally speaking, we won't bring a deal to the table with small exceptions. We won't bring them unless we're investing in these deals. We absolutely want to put the skin in the game to participate. Under some rare circumstances, it is possible the deal may not be suitable to a fund, but may be suitable to some Freedom Founders investors because of some certain circumstances. But in general, we're always going to put kind of our money in the deal. We're going to have skin in the game. That's about it.
Great presentation. So kind of to recap, alternative investments. It's a huge opportunity because of the inefficiency of the marketplace as opposed to Wall Street. Great opportunities. You just need to have access. You've got to have education. You need to do this kind of investing with a group, with people that have your best interests at heart, that can help you not only know what you're doing so you put the right money in the right buckets, but in the right deals, with the right structures, with the right downside risk. All the things that Mike covered on the presentation is the way to do it if you're going to get into alternative investments. So again, opportunities for you to follow up because we love to serve. We love to educate. Even if you never do anything with us at all, just to keep you safe, get the education. So you can get a copy of my book, From High Income to High Net Worth, written specifically for professional practice owners at freedomfounders.com/gift. If you think you'd like to be a part of the Freedom Founders Mastermind, it is by application. We keep a very tight-knit group. If it's not your right time, we'll let you know when it is the right time. Again, freedomfounders.com/apply. Mike, go back to your slide again to follow up with Mike. Great educator. He's got his book on Amazon. Email him at mike@tempofunding.com. Be glad to send you a copy. And again, you can find him at tempofunding.com, bigmikefund.com. That's his podcast, which is a great podcast. I've been on that a few times. And just follow up either way you want to. We'd love to help you at the right place, right time for you. Just remember, always be safe in your investments. Don't speculate unless you've got know what you're doing with that speculation. Mike, any final comments?
David, thank you for your leadership. I greatly appreciate everything you do. You are a great inspirational leader, and I just enjoy these discussions so much. And you make a difference in people's lives. You're really bringing financial freedom to folks, and I'm blessed to be your friend and part of your team. So I appreciate you, and Freedom Founders is just a phenomenal mastermind. I've been to it so many times, folks. When you get a chance, apply, and you will see the difference in your life.
Mike, always a pleasure. Thank you much. Thank you for staying with us to the end here. Again, we'll do more of these. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you want to know more of. Just put it in the chat box, and we'll do more of these. When we know what you want, we went pretty fast today to give you quite a bit of an overview. But this is the stuff you've got to know. It's the opportunity that's available for you. So, again, Mike, thank you so much, everybody. Thanks for being with us. We'll talk to you hopefully soon. Take care.
You too. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to bigmikefund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike's Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.